we see some little bright spots here and there as communities have started to take more of a public health approach. And we believe that the state of confusion is not a permanent state, that the fog is not impenetrable, that with good information, people can do things that can help their families, and communities, cities, counties, states can take actions that can really save a lot of lives.
This is Roughly Speaking, Newsroom Edition, the flagship podcast of the Baltimore Sun, featuring stories from our city and our state that you can't get anywhere else. I'm Pamela Wood. Thank you for joining us. This week, in a special episode of Newsroom Edition, Baltimore Sun investigative reporter Doug Donovan speaks with Baltimore's own Ingvild Olsen and Joshua Sharfstein about the book on the opioid crisis that they co-authored for the Oxford University Press's What Everyone Needs to Know series. Think of it like an academic version of the opioid crisis for dummies. Doug has written a lot about opioids for The Sun, and he was struck by the no-nonsense approach of this book. He welcomed them into our sound studio in April.
I recently came across the opioid epidemic, What Everyone Needs to Know. What really attracted me to this book was its easy and accessible language, which is the hallmark of the Oxford University Press's What Everyone Needs to Know series. It's a really important book as the opioid crisis has devastated communities across the nation over the past several years, especially in states like Maryland, where the number of overdose deaths per year has escalated into the thousands. Dr. Ingvild Olsen and Dr. Joshua Sharfstein, who also happen to still be married even after co-writing this book, join me today to discuss some of the misconceptions about this public health crisis and what lawmakers, physicians, and others in the medical community can do to address the calamity. Welcome to Roughly Speaking, Dr. Olsen and Dr. Sharfstein.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Dr. Olsen, can you let our listeners know a little bit about who you are and what your background is?
Sure. So I am an addiction medicine physician. I trained as a general internal primary care physician, but really have spent my formative part of my training, as well as the last 15 years in practice, seeing patients with addiction, particularly opioid addiction. And now I am the medical director for an outpatient comprehensive addiction treatment center here in Baltimore City called the Institutes for Behavioral Resources, Reach Health Services.
Great. And Dr. Sharfstein, can you familiarize our listeners with your career here?
Sure. I'm a pediatrician, and I was the health commissioner of the city of Baltimore from 2005 to 2009. Later, I worked as the secretary of Maryland's health department, and since 2015, I've been at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us and talking about this important topic. I want to start off with some of the basics, given all the stigma that persists about addiction in general, a lot of which I think centers around the disbelief that addiction is a disease. So what is opioid addiction and what makes it a disease?
So you're not alone in having that misunderstanding. Opioid addiction is really characterized by kind of pathological craving and compulsion to use, to engage in behaviors that have harmful and negative consequences, and that they continue despite those harmful and negative consequences, even up to the point of death. And it has really been now understood as a primary chronic disease of the brain. So it originates in the brain. But it involves a complex interaction between genetics. About 40 to 60% of the risk of developing an addiction is genetically based. And it also has interactions with someone's environment. So trauma, for example, is a big risk factor, as well as other risk factors such as people having depression and other mental health conditions. So all of those things together in any one individual causes an addiction. What it's not is a moral failing or a lack of willpower. And I think that sometimes is where people misunderstand that addiction as a disease is something we can prevent, something we can treat, and it's a medical condition that people really don't have any control over.
So is there an effective treatment for opioid addiction, and how does relapse factor into that treatment?
So absolutely there is effective treatment. And we now have about 50 years of solid evidence, particularly for the treatment of opioid addiction. There are several different components, so kind of main three different components that comprise effective treatment. They include medications, counseling and other support services and other services that people might need, and then really importantly, the recovery support services. And we have three FDA-approved medications now available to us for the effective treatment of opioid addiction. They include methadone, buprenorphine, and naltrexone. They come in different flavors, in different formulations. And where relapse fits in is that because addiction is a chronic disease, it has the opportunity for relapse and recovery. Just like other chronic diseases such as diabetes that may have exacerbations, people with addiction may end up in remission and recovery where they really don't have any symptoms of their disease, but then something happens and they have a recurrence of their symptoms, kind of a relapse.
And if I could jump in, I'd say that a big misconception is that if someone's relapsed, well, then it's a complete failure.
Right.
And so people will say, like, well, they were in treatment for 2 years, but then they relapsed.
Right.
One of the things I learned from the book, from the part that Dr. Olson wrote, was that there's a lot to be learned from a relapse. And in fact, a good clinical setting, a good physician can hear, well, what caused the relapse this time? Let's figure out not only how to get you better again so that you're in remission, but also what you can do differently to avoid another relapse like that. And I don't know, maybe it would help to give an example of a patient of yours.
Sure. So I've taken care of a number of patients, but I'll tell you about one patient who was actually in, started out in treatment, was taking methadone as part of their treatment, and coming to counseling services. And in fact, you know, really it was able to stabilize on the medications and with the supports that we were able to provide. And this is a gentleman who is in his 50s. He had a really severe addiction for many, many years, had lost his job, lost his family, and then was able to stabilize. Several months went by. He would come see me, you know, initially once a week, then every 2 weeks, and then once a month. And then, you know, something kind of, he missed an appointment. And I thought, well, that's really unusual. That's not like him. We tried to call him, and he said, oh, sorry, something came up. I said, well, you know, please come back. And in fact, this gentleman said on the phone, oh, well, I didn't think you wanted me to come back because I used again.
Hmm.
I started using. And I said, no, of course we want you to come back. You know, that's
right.
We don't want to give up on you, right? You know, had this, you were managing your disease, you were taking your medication, you were getting together back with your family. We really want to help you get back there.
Right.
So he came back in, and it took a little while because he ended up having his wife kind of say, you know, not this again.
Right.
Because sometimes that happens, that people kind of have exacerbations and relapses. Fortunately, he was really able to, with some more intensification of his treatment, he was able to get back and restabilize and get back his life, his wife, and he went back to work.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing. It's how the moral failing stigma permeates even the addict's opinion of their recovery. They think that if I relapse, somehow I have failed and I'm done. Whereas if you had diabetes or some other chronic disease, you know, you're going to have that for probably the rest of your life. And so this is something you have to have maintenance with. And where I guess that's where methadone comes in as a maintenance drug and buprenorphine as a maintenance drug. And the language around that is really important, which the book also touches on, getting over sort of the stigmatizing language that we use as well.
Including not using the word addict.
Correct. Yeah. The word addict. Can you explain why the word addict is something that helps to perpetuate that stigma?
Well, I think the goal is person-centered language, that the people are people first. So you may be a person with addiction, but you're a person, not an addict, which sort of depersonalizes the individual. And interestingly, there have been studies, including by Dr. Colleen Berry and others at the School of Public Health, which looks at different language and how people respond to it. And depending on the way someone is described, the support for helping them will change by like 20 points.
Wow.
You know, from 20% to 40% or 40% to 60%, depending on what you're asking,
right.
Or more. So for that reason, we take care to try to use person-centered language.
There's another really interesting study around the word abuse, because we used to call this substance abuse.
Right.
And John Kelly, who's a researcher at the Harvard School of Public Health, did a randomized trial, so a study, a controlled study, where he essentially gave a group of mental health professionals two vignettes. Mm. And the only difference in those vignettes was that in one vignette, the person was described as being a substance abuser. And in the other vignette, the person was described as a person with a substance use disorder. And they had this group of mental health professionals kind of randomly see one vignette or the other, and then they asked them a series of questions about attitudes and how would you approach this person. There were many, many, many more negative attitudes, even when you just have the word substance abuser versus a person with a substance use disorder. And these were mental health professionals.
Wow. It seems as if there hopefully is a paradigm shift going on in terms of how we talk about this as a public health crisis. And you've seen that as being a city health commissioner, I'm sure, having to overcome that stigma and that language and that concept of even this year, like in the Maryland General Assembly, when they were talking about allowing some of these medications into jails, there were legislators who were still wondering, well, when they get out, will they be cured, essentially?
Mm-hmm.
So recovery is not so much a cure. You don't get cured. You are in a maintenance program of some sort, right? I mean, and
right.
that helps you with long-term recovery.
I think that, you know, the concept of a moral failing goes along with the idea of, like, just get it together and you'll
right.
be fixed,
right.
you know, and let's just get it done with. And it is totally possible to empathize with someone who wants their loved one to be completely better.
Right.
Because we all want our loved ones to be completely better. But the challenge of a chronic brain disorder is that, you know, it's going to take some time for things to really completely calm down. And even then, it's just something that is there. And, you know, you can make peace with that. And if you support someone, they can do incredibly well. And the book is full of stories of examples of people who have, you know, are doing things not only for themselves, but to help so many other people.
Right.
You know, and it's really special when you, you know, see that happen. But it's not... It's not possible if people are thinking that this is something that can be fixed in a 28-day program, for example.
Right.
And that there really is no cure. I think you absolutely are correct in saying that, you know, people can learn how to manage their chronic disease, just like people with diabetes learn to manage their diabetes. And people can and do recover, meaning that they, you know, really are moving away from the symptoms and the behaviors that are so out of control and that cause people harm when they have addiction.
And, you know, when we talk about this, we'll say, look, there are these medications. They work very well. People can do very stably. They can recover. They can achieve these sustained remissions. And it's like question number one. Won't marijuana cure this if you take a little marijuana? You know, there is no evidence that marijuana treats opioid use disorder. Next question.
Right.
There's some hallucinogen in Mexico, I heard, it reorders the brain. It's like, you know, it's like question number five. And it's still like, is there just some quick fix out there? There's
right.
got to be some quick fix. And there's great evidence for the treatments that exist, but they're not quick fixes.
Mm-hmm. I feel like that gets to a lot of what I was going to ask in terms of what can we do as everyday citizens, especially if we suspect someone we know or love is misusing opioids. A lot of it might center around the language we use, the expectations we carry as loved ones, to know that recovery will be a process. There isn't a specific cure-all that's going to fix things after 28 days. But those are other things that people should do upon reading this book if they do suspect someone is misusing opioids.
Well, I think it's really important to understand how life-saving treatment can be. And I think it's really important for people to have a caring approach, but also a directed approach. In Baltimore, there are treatment resources. There are numbers to call. There are places to go to get really terrific care from Dr. Olson and her colleagues or at other places. And constantly reminding people, helping people connect in a non-judgmental way, but doesn't mean you don't say anything. If you think people need help, you can help connect them to that help.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, as we write in the book, that family members often are the first ones that will suspect that there is something happening with their loved one, that their loved one may be misusing opioids. And it's natural to get really anxious. But I think one of the keys is take a deep breath. Try not to become so overly anxious that people become paralyzed, because there really are things you can do. Voice your concerns in a non-judgmental, caring, concerning way. And one of the things about addiction is that when people really are in the throes of it and are very symptomatic from it, they really can't necessarily see it for themselves. And so there may be resistance when family members point out very specific behaviors that mm-hmm. they're concerned about. But that's okay. You've shared your concern and shared your love with that person to say, I'm here when you need me. I think the other thing, as Dr. Sharfstein said, is really to seek out effective treatments, to seek out advice from trusted healthcare professionals. There are various different hotlines in Baltimore City or also in Maryland and at the federal level that people can connect to. And the last thing I would say about this is that family members also need to understand that they need help. They may need help themselves mm-hmm. because this can be, and for very often, can be extremely stressful for the family.
Right.
I would just say that even if people aren't ready right then to go into treatment, there are other kinds of places and services in Baltimore that exist, and calling to find out about them can help, for example, connect with syringe services programs here in the city where people can at least be safer and mm-hmm. at the same time connect with peers and others who can help them see the value of treatment.
I wanted to have you sort of tell our listeners sort of your best elevator pitch on why they should read this book. Why is it very important for them to pick this book up? I think you can pre-order it on Amazon. It's coming out in June. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So what about this book should appeal to everyday citizens?
So my hope with this book is that it really provides some basic information to all the questions, and if not all, many of the questions that I get from family members, from colleagues, from my patients, and from policymakers and other folks who really are trying to understand this and trying to understand how they can address this and be part of the solution. And hopefully we give some helpful information so that anyone, whatever part of any system they are, that they will get something out of it. And knowledge is power.
Right.
So hopefully this will help people get some more knowledge. Mm-hmm. And with that, we can really together collectively move forward in addressing the opiate epidemic and the opiate addiction and overdose epidemic. But also, I think, set kind of the groundwork for really moving us in a public health direction for addiction in general.
I would just say that Dr. Olson did the first draft of all the clinical pieces.
Okay.
I did the first draft of the public health pieces, and then we went and edited each other's part,
right.
and then we took a deep breath and discussed it.
Okay.
her part, I learned a tremendous amount from. And I would say what I really didn't appreciate is how well these two parts really do go together. That understanding what's going on in the brain, understanding the kinds of things that can help people one person at a time
yeah.
is really helpful to understanding the kinds of policies that can be put in place by a governor, by a mayor.
Right.
Who wrote the book is mm-hmm. because we saw that confusion about the epidemic was really harming the response.
Hmm.
That people were investing in the wrong things.
Right.
People were spending their life savings on, you know, 28-day programs that
right.
said they would cure your child.
Correct.
You know,
it looked more like spas than
right.
really
yeah.
anything.
And that there was still, you know, war on drugs kind of rhetoric, and if we just arrest everyone, we'll get out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, some of those things aren't just, like, not helpful. They're actually actively making the problem worse.
Right.
And in the book, we say, like, the state of confusion
mm-hmm.
on opioids is its own crisis.
Right.
We're starting to see that confusion lift in some places. Where we see in Rhode Island where they treated everyone who came into the jail or prison with medications and other treatment and strong follow-up when they left, and they had a more than 60% decline in overdoses.
Right.
We see some little bright spots here and there as communities have started to take more of a public health approach.
Right.
And I think we believe that the state of confusion is not a permanent state, that the fog is not impenetrable,
correct,
that with good information, people can do things that can help their families, and communities, cities, counties, states can take actions that can really save a lot of lives.
Personally, I think every lawmaker should read the book just so they have an understanding of the everything that comes up in the book. So when they're making legislation around addiction treatment, they don't have to reinvent the wheel. They can see pretty much A to Z how we got to where we are and what works, what doesn't work. As a parent, I also find it incredibly helpful to know that you don't have to go through the pain and suffering if you have all this knowledge in advance. I have three kids. I want to make sure, I hope they don't become substance use, if they
disorders.
Don't have substance
yeah,
use disorder,
exactly. yeah.
folks. And reading this, I know that I feel like I'm better equipped and educated to address it if that does happen. Or if other loved ones, I've had other loved ones go through addiction years ago. And, you really have to reinvent the wheel every time you go through it with somebody because it's so different for each person. And reading the book, it makes me feel like had I known that like a decade ago, it would have made that process of helping somebody much easier. So that's to me, that's the most powerful part of the book is it gives you everything you need to know in one place.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have to go through the pain to get that information.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for having. Thanks for coming in. I greatly appreciate the conversation. I think that's all our questions.
Doug, thank you so much. And that wraps up this week's Newsroom Edition. Thank you for joining us. For more audio from the Baltimore Sun, head on over to baltimoresun.com/roughlyspeaking and be sure to check us out every Friday. And while times may change, the need for quality journalism doesn't. So please consider subscribing to the Baltimore Sun at baltimoresun.com/subscribe. For producers Hallie Miller and Steve Early, thanks again, and we'll see you back here next time.